Welcome to the podcast Social Work Successes, which aims to shine a big spotlight on the brilliant work that social work professionals do with children and families every day, because this is just not celebrated enough. Practitioners will be sharing their stories, which will hopefully not only inspire others, but also provide some helpful learning in relation to factors that may have contributed to that success. You guys deserve far more recognition than this podcast can give, but thank you for listening and everything you do for the families you work with. Welcome to the podcast Social Work Successes. Today I am joined by Natalie, and I came across Natalie because quite uniquely she has stepped into the world of social worker well-being. And I was really drawn to a lot of her posts where she was talking about the importance of self-care and regulation within that world. And I just thought, yes, this is so needed and so important, because the work that social workers are doing, I'll let her say more about it, but it's obviously hugely stressful at times. There's a lot of vicarious trauma going around and absorption of a lot of complexities in that whole way. So I just thought, yeah, this is really important. I'm sure she's got a success story of her own from practice as well to share. So I got her on. So thank you very much, Natalie. But yeah, if you just want to start maybe by explaining a little bit about what you are doing within that role, and then we'll go back in time and revisit the practice stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that introduction. As you said, so my name is Natalie Robertson. I am the founder of The Social Life. And what I do is support social workers to basically understand how to regulate their autonomic nervous system and process their emotions that are often underlying that constant cycle of burnout. So you've already touched on some of the pressures, which is like the vicarious trauma, but then also the overwhelming caseloads, the complexities, and often just feeling like there's never enough time, feeling so overwhelmed and stressed, and the impacts that that then has on how we function, on our own well-being as social workers, and the knock-on effect on the children and families. Because ultimately, if we're constantly stressed and overwhelmed and burned out to the point where actually we're not in a place where we can really be the best we can for the children and families we support, because we're either leaving the profession or calling in sick quite frequently, not even able to give enough time and space to the families because we're constantly thinking about the next thing. It's such important work for social workers to learn how to understand those signs in their nervous system, what happens for them when they're feeling that stress and overwhelm, because it looks so different for everybody. And what I do through my coaching program and through my training is supporting social workers to really understand not only the importance of looking after their well-being, but actually practical tips on how to do so for themselves in their daily life, and really process those emotions and the need to save, the need to fix, the need to constantly be there to support others, but not support ourselves. And it's something that, yeah, deeply rooted in, I think, every social worker I've ever met. It's a real challenge, but I think we're not taught early in our practice. So that's why I'm so passionate about bringing it to everyone, really.
So, picking up on what you said about the tips that you shared, that's what I think I've really liked. Again, people in this profession, they don't have time, do they, to pore over long, lengthy posts, or people need things that are just bite size and able to pick up. And that's what I've loved, again, about your tips and things as well. So everybody who's listening, do check out The Social Life on Instagram and on LinkedIn too, because yeah, I think all of that information is so needed. We could probably spend the whole episode talking about why and getting into it even more in the practicalities of what that role looks like and why it's so needed, but yeah, go check out that stuff. Okay, so going backwards a little bit in time to hear your success story, so what was the role that you were doing in practice at that time?
So the story I'm going to tell is actually about a young person, a family that I worked with quite early in my career when I first started out in youth offending. So this is going back about 7 years now, six, seven years into my practice. And it's such a powerful story because this young person came through at a time in his life where, I mean, he was about 13, 14, came through on something called a referral order, which is an order that that the courts will give to a young person, usually around their first offence. Depending on the seriousness, sometimes they're given a caution, a referral order goes through the courts, though, and this was due to possession of Class B, a small possession of Class B drugs. But actually, this young person also had pending matters through the courts for possession with intent to supply Class A substances as well. So he was really young at the time that he became involved in that kind of lifestyle. And yeah, the work that I was then able to do with him and his family was really a blessing, I'd say, for me, but also it was actually just implanting the seeds, I believe, to then be able to see the drastic changes it made for him in the long term, which was really, really amazing.
Okay, so I guess it's helpful to maybe hear a little bit about up until that point, what did his life kind of look like? What had been the struggles or difficulties within that family unit for him?
Yeah. So, I mean, bless him. His family, significant generational trauma. His early years, and this came out like halfway through my working with him, but early years he had experienced abuse from his mother's ex-partner, as did his siblings as well. And then being able to just see the impact that then had on him in education, where he was constantly in and out of different schools. He then ended up in a pupil referral unit, where he still had ongoing challenges. He was still regulating his own emotions, quite a lot of anger that he really struggled with. And then just seeing the impact on his mother as well, because she would often have seizures, which were often related to his outbursts. Then it was really interesting to see the way that trauma impacted her and her body. A lot of unprocessed emotions there for the whole family. And stepping into that family, I think initially for me, just that feeling of like overwhelm, like, oh my gosh, this is a big one. Because usually when we get our referrals, we like read what we read on paper, not really too sure what you're going to walk into. And I remember my first visit, actually, I was sat in the living room chatting with his mum, talking about obviously the reason for our involvement. And actually, it was always quite, I found it a lot easier to talk about the involvement when I work in youth offending, because I'd often be like, oh, it's not me that it's the courts that have told me that I need to be here. So don't worry, it's not my fault. Kind of, it was easier to build relationships often off of that. And yeah, having chat with his mum, and he was sat on the stairs just completely icy, like so uninterested. So I think that they'd had social workers in and out of their lives, but working in children from children and family social workers in and out of their life for years. Due to domestic abuse that had gone on in the past, different challenges with his siblings' mental health, and it was just like another professional, like what do you want? What are you doing here? Kind of thing. And yeah, I'd say those were the challenges initially. And I remember the first conversation I'd had with him and his mum. He completely just from 0 to 100. I wasn't even really clear on the trigger at the time. It's like his mum was helping to explain something that he said to me. He just lost it. He felt like he was being disrespected by his mum when my perspective or perception of the situation was completely different. So it was just really interesting to see. And I'd say that was the start of our of the relationship building, actually, because his mum then got really overwhelmed and upset. So I actually asked for her to leave the room while I spoke to this young person. And then him being able to then de-escalate, because I remained sat down. I didn't stand up to like, because I think that would have maybe heightened his anxieties at the time. And he eventually calmed down and sat next to me and just really explained like how he was feeling. And I was like, you know, I can understand that. But actually my perspective of the situation was that actually your mum was trying to support you in this. So it's interesting that that's how you felt in that moment. And yeah, I think my approach has always been to just be as open as possible to families and understanding that they will come with all sorts of different challenges, and often just asking myself, how can I take a step back in the situation and not make it about my feelings and my overwhelm and my stress and anxiety? Because that, in the times that I have maybe not always been conscious of my overwhelming feelings, it has then become about how can I not feel this? So sometimes we'll create disconnection in relationships with families, or it will then create I guess it then becomes about us and us trying to avoid discomfort as well. So really being able to just sit with that, sit with the discomfort and be able to be open to building a relationship regardless of what's gonna maybe happen next was really, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so interesting, isn't it? Because you need to be so conscious of all of that. And if someone hasn't brought it to your awareness, this just wouldn't be on your radar. You would just be practicing, wouldn't you, as you were, and you just wouldn't have that awareness of how much this is all being absorbed. And being aware of those triggers and having that style of conversation, I still think for a lot of social workers, that's just not on the map. And there's probably more, a lot more of that disconnect as a way of just a coping mechanism to deal with that, those kind of more extreme situations that can happen. What was your remit, I guess, for doing work with him and the sessions? I guess he's in a situation where he has to work with you because it's part of the order. But yeah, what did that work look like with him?
So usually initially when starting off a referral order or any order with a young person, it looks like actually beginning to one, we have to do some an assessment. So we'll have to really explore actually what is his lived experience, what was the reason behind him committing the offences, but also how can we then begin to support him through the order. So we'll come up with a really clear plan of things that he would want to do and want to throughout the it was 9 months initially, and then it extended due to other matters. And what that looked like was one, being able to sit down in a meeting with him and his mum and a panel and panel members to sign a piece of work. The challenge was actually getting him in the room initially. I remember we had to reschedule several times to be able to support him to feel safe enough to enter into that meeting space. But eventually what we did, and it was an absolute blessing actually to be in a local group that had access to some amazing resources. So we did a lot of like relationship building. I would go out to regular home visits to him and his family, often sat on the floor with him and his siblings and mum, just like talking, because I found that a lot of his struggle was actually just being able to sit and have a conversation. And I think he felt really challenged in having conversations, especially in front of his mother. So just kind of basically taking a lot of the pressures off and then figuring out actually what it was that he wanted to work on. Because he was actually very ambitious, very sporty, got really into his football. There was actually a carpentry project that was amazing. So able to make a referral through to that service, which a lot of the young people absolutely loved.
And had he ever had any sort of therapeutic, intervention, and how had he experienced that or found that?
So he had never engaged with any therapeutic services until he made a disclosure about the abuse he experienced. And then we were able to make a referral through to CAMHS. It was a challenge with the waiting list. So actually his school, the pupil referral unit he was actually really supportive around that. And as much as there was a lot of struggles around him being like suspended at certain points in his schooling, they were actually able to support him with some therapeutic intervention whilst waiting to be seen by a CAMHS practitioner. So that was really positive as well. And I think also just being able to feel open enough to speak about it in the first step was really powerful. But initially, and I think the struggles were actually he hadn't had that in-depth therapeutic support, which is why he struggled so much with not only regulating his emotions, but actually even just beginning to process it. Because I think there was a lot of shame associated. There was a lot of hurt and a lot of anger, I think, directed at his mother, but also kind of everyone around him just because he was fighting so much. So yeah, the access to resources was yeah amazing. And I do believe life-changing for him. But I know it's so challenging as well in practice when especially not every local authority, not every service will have the access to be able to reach out to services. And I mean, this was going back 7 years now, but CAMHS waiting lists have skyrocketed since then. So the challenge around young people being able to access mental health services is really, really difficult. And I know a lot of schools are brilliant at being able to begin to fill that gap. But
It's
yeah,
almost like we need, especially to kind of engage with that group of children that have gone down that path of youth offending already. And when we know
that 90% of those, probably more, will have had some sort of attachment trauma going on for them. It's a shame we can't create our own kind of therapeutic service that they could just tap into that isn't CAMHS, but it's just like a resource that is there. Because again, if it comes down to funding, you have to think, well, if that trauma is left unprocessed, then any other sort of, like, any kind of criminal ways of punishment are not going to make that disappear. It's not going to go anywhere. It's still going to be there. All of those
Absolutely.
vulnerabilities are still going to be there. So that's just, it's like, it's not even, I wouldn't even call it a sticking plaster. It's like, I don't know, trying to think of a better analogy. It's more just like a piece of paper saying you've done something wrong.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
So that's a, you know, that I yeah, and I completely agree. In the last 7 years, referral rates, which in some ways is a good thing, it's because mental health has been put on the map far more. Trauma has been put on the map far more, but the services haven't caught up with that. And yeah, and I always say, I bang on about this all the time on LinkedIn. Like, of course, it always comes down to finance, but actually, if you invested in this ahead of time, then the savings are huge. And especially when we've got children that are going into, like, down the criminal route, of course, to try and prevent that early with the right kind of therapeutic intervention, it's like a
And I'm a
no-brainer.
yeah, I'm a huge believer in like early intervention support. Like I've absolutely loved being able to do early intervention work. One of my last roles was actually in a school-based social work team where I was based in nurseries, like being able to support families, parents, and children at really early stages in their life, because ultimately it's about being able to help support at the source rather than waiting years and years for that trauma to build up and begin to do something. So as much as that work is important, having the early intervention funding so crucial, and it really makes such a huge difference. I think often it's harder to measure. So I think sometimes maybe bigger organizations don't really see the impact fast enough. So that's often quite a challenge as well. But yeah.
Okay, so which part of this work together would you consider to have been a success?
So I'd say the success actually came a couple years after I finished working with this family. So I was in youth offending for 2.5, nearly 3 years. And in working with him and his family, I ended up having to hand over to one of my colleagues as I was leaving. And it was a really difficult one of those families that you actually don't want to leave because you want to be able to see the work through. I wanted to really be able to just kind of support him, continue to support him in his journey, because we built up a really good working relationship. And often in youth offending, it would be very long-term work when it's quite a serious incident. So it's, as much as it can be a challenge as well, it was a real blessing to be able to be part of his journey, supporting him through his education, through therapeutic interventions, making sure he's getting access to work and all those kind of sorts of things as he was getting older. But then as I left, I handed over to one of my colleagues. And I think sometimes in social work as well, like the challenge is really in not knowing what's going to happen next. So whether you're closing a family that you're working with, or whether it's you're leaving the service and like not too sure what's going to happen next. And for me, I know, especially early on in my career, like having like wanting to be the one to fix and do everything, because I was so like so tightly associating, I think, my own worth to being able to help other people. So yeah, I think definitely was a bit of a challenge leaving. But then realizing actually, I think it was about 2 years on when my supervisor, my old supervisor at the time, he sent me a message of a picture of this young person, a few pictures, and basically saying that he wanted to thank me for, I guess, being part of the beginning stages of his journey. And he'd done such amazing work and finished doing such amazing work with my colleague as well. And yeah, he like ended, he finished his order that he'd completed. But then he'd also got a qualification through carpentry. He was working, he was doing his football, and he's in such an incredible place. And the beaming smile on his face, I was just like, oh, it was just in knowing that not even about, I think in many moments, especially in that time where I was struggling with leaving and not knowing what would happen next, at that moment, I definitely was making it about myself. But I think ultimately, everything happens perfectly as it will do. And it's in that knowing, actually, even if we're not sure about what the outcome is going to be, sometimes it's just planting that seed. We don't always get to see how it grows. We don't always get to see the outcome of it. But knowing that actually the work we do is so meaningful and it makes such a difference, no matter how small it may feel, no matter how insignificant it may feel, especially, and I think especially working with teenagers, where sometimes it's like, is this even getting through to this kid? Like, it feels like in one ear out of the other, especially when they're giving you attitude. But really and truly, like, that, don't ever underestimate the power of your voice. Don't ever underestimate the power of being able to just sit there and listen as well, and being that space, that safe space for somebody in moments where they may not have had anybody else to be there or listen.
And
Yeah, it makes such a
I often talk about in my training this idea of sometimes you can feel like it's a wasted visit if all you're doing is the listening, but actually just sitting and listening and being that kind of listening therapeutic containment is enough. Like that's a visit well spent. That's time well spent with a parent or a young person or a child. If all you have achieved is sitting there and listening, then that's a brilliant piece of work as well.
Absolutely.
So
I think,
yeah, okay. So what would you say were the three biggest contributors to the success story for him?
I'd say to start with, definitely the relationship that we were able to build. So the openness, I think the safety in that for him as well, and being able to just be heard, to be genuinely cared about in that moment. And safe enough to then be able to open up about significant trauma that he'd experienced was really, was, I think, really the turning point for him at that point in his life. But then also building the relationship with his mum, and I guess seeing, like, he literally sat there on the floor with his sisters, and being able to have that like open conversations and just kind of relax, which is a space their family hadn't been in for a long time. So yeah, I'd always really encourage social workers to just be as personable as possible in practice. But then also the access to resources really makes a difference. So at the time, being able to, I think often sometimes we want to make referrals, but there's a waiting list or there's just not access to it in the maybe the local authority you're working in. It does make a huge difference to be able to explore. So I'd say look into as many resources as you can. If you can, like, get funding, explore panels, look into funding to be able to access different resources, because it's really about making the work we do as bespoke as possible for the young people, because not every service will be perfect for them. And then also just having support from my supervisor at the time and colleagues as a team, because often there was a lot of challenges, especially in terms of, like, the trauma and the vicarious trauma, I'd say, but, like, in hearing the stories from himself, from his mother, taking that home, like, can be so difficult, especially at, say, at that point in my career, not really knowing or learning the strategies to process those things, because ultimately it can bring up so much challenge, like, so much difficult emotions for ourselves as well.
And supervision is not really the place for often unpicking that. I mean, I've had some brilliant supervisors, but I've also had some who they're sort of there with their notebook ready to get onto the planning, risk assessment, what's going on stage with the family, and they've gone, "So how are you?" And it's like, oh God, I'm okay. Because, like, the answer has to be quick. You've asked me the question quickly. Let's keep it quick. But yeah, so there's just not a space for that. Like, it's almost like you need two supervisions. One's like a therapeutic space container, the other is the practical planning risk assess one. I mean, nobody has time for two supervisions. People barely have time for one, but that's a
Well,
thought I've often had.
saying that though, I like my current role. So I'm working as well as doing the social life. I also work full time as an ASY assessor and consultant social worker for a London local authority. And literally, my whole job is to do reflective supervision for qualified social workers and deliver training. So having that space to have case supervision and reflective supervision, it makes a world of difference, because it's really supporting them in processing things that are going on for them, but also understanding actually what. How can I just begin to take a step back from me? What what am I making about me in these moments? Because sometimes if you're feeling really awkward, you're feeling really disrespected or whatever it is in those moments, ultimately, how can we learn to respond effectively versus reacting from our childhood wounds or our reactive patterns? So it's really, yeah, I love that you
And
just said
that emotion of disrespect, if you are holding that, then that is inevitably going to impact two things, I think, your judgment and your planning of, and your engagement. Three things, those three things. If you are holding a sense of feeling disrespected by a parent, like that's got to be processed, unpicked, talked about, moved forward from, because there's no way you can have that kind of relationship-based practice holding that. But it's also understandable that people could feel that given what they may have kind of come across. So, but yeah, processing that's so important. Okay, so the last question is, what do you love most about your job?
The thing I love most about my job, about social work in general, is just the connection, like the being able to be involved in people's lives in ways that really is unheard of in any other walk of life, really. Like the vulnerability that we get to experience with the families we work with, but now even the social workers that I support on a daily basis, the openness, the willingness to begin to connect. It takes a lot of courage, and I don't think it's really recognized enough. And I just love that. I genuinely feel and believe at the moment that my true work, like the work I do, is just bringing people joy and helping them to process and just uncover their own joy and peace within. Because ultimately, the things that we go through in our lives, the challenges, we end up pushing all of that down because we're feeling overwhelmed, we're feeling stressed, we're feeling like everything is too much. But actually, ultimately, we don't have to internalize those stresses. Yes, there is pressure in every area of our lives, but we can begin to navigate that better and begin to really understand how to hold space for ourselves, and practice true self-love, self-compassion. So yeah, I love my job. I love what I do.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Natalie.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is really in its infancy phase, so please do like, share, subscribe, tell your colleagues, tell your managers, tell anyone else that you think might benefit. Thank you.